Welcome to Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders. Each episode, LRB Health's Keith Viglioli will talk to the healthcare insiders who are helping to fundamentally transform our healthcare industry.
Hey everybody, this is Tom Salembi of Device Talks. Welcome back to Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders. We've got the ultimate insider here, Keith Viglioli of LRB Health. Keith, you are embarking on another ambitious podcast journey. Want to tell our listeners what you are up to?
It's ambitious, and we have quite the kickoff guest.
You do.
So I'm pretty excited about this one. It was a fun one because, as I was saying to you in the preamble, like, I was quite sick, and out of all the people to be sick for an interview, this was not one for that.
No.
Somehow I plowed through and got through it, and we're quite excited to share that Mark Cuban has stepped up to the first episode in this new series around pharmacy. And so we've been spending a lot of time at the firm, along with our network, around kind of pharmacy services, all the key trends in and around that, and in particular around specialty pharmacy, since 90% of most drugs that are coming through the pipeline these days are specialty in nature. And that changes a lot of things in terms of how pharma and then the various players, PBMs, insurers, and ultimately health systems have to interact with that and docs. So we've just been exploring this for probably over a year now. And then my partner, Josh, and I got excited about this idea of like, hey, what if we brought in a couple of thought leaders to the podcast and talked a little bit about some of the pressing issues? And so I couldn't think of a better person than Mark Cuban. Luckily, he said yes.
I'm sure it won't be a letdown after this, but you're right. It's a great way to start. I'm not an insider when it comes to healthcare or pharmacies. I'm a consumer of pharmacies. And just from my perspective, things look like they're just a mess in the pharmacy world. What is the insider perspective? Is it as bad from the inside as it looks from the outside?
I think that's Mark's point of view. I think a couple of fun telling things he said in the interview was, you know, I asked him point blank because he invests in so many different industries, but so many, you know, sides on the consumer side. I was like, is this the hardest industry you've ever invested in? He said, no, complete opposite. It's the easiest industry ever.
That's amazing.
And the easiest industry to disrupt. And his whole point, which I think is a really, probably the most important point of this discussion with him, is that all the people that are incrementally trying to change healthcare, and this is his point, maybe not my point, are part of the problem and will never disrupt the system. The people that are looking way is not an insider, but as an outsider, and want to do something totally different, which he would argue his cost plus platform is doing, those are the people that truly will disrupt the industry and gain most of the value. Now, we could debate that for hours. We don't have hours. But I thought it was a very salient point about where his mind comes from. You know, many people have seen him on Shark Tank, but I don't think a lot of people have heard him talk sort of his points of view on healthcare. And the final point I would say is, one thing I've picked up in doing research on him and talking with him a bit is, you know, he is, obviously everybody knows he's ridiculously smart, but he is ridiculously ruthless when it comes to understanding issues. What he talks about and I bring up is this idea of reading the manual, which is if you're going to jump into any of these projects or healthcare, you really need to read the manual on healthcare. So if the ACA comes out and you're not reading the manual, you're going to miss a lot of pieces.
Right.
I thought it was a really good point.
That is a great point. So did he come into this area, and we'll hear it here in the interview, I'm sure, identifying this as an area where he can create a very profitable venture and that's why he's entering? Or is he coming in as on some sort of campaign to change healthcare? Is he completely motivated by the profit that can be made, or does he just want to disrupt an industry that desperately needs disrupting and he knows he's one of the people who can do it?
I don't know how he would answer that. When you get directly into that, we got to. And I think a lot of this stemmed from, you know, he's got a pretty sizable organization. I think it's like 800 people or something like that, that runs all the things that he does. And I think this hit home for his family because he's on a family story. And I think this hit home for his business. And regardless of a bunch of people talking about this and a bunch of start and stops, whether it's, you know, I brought up Healthcare Transformation Alliance, which was, you know, the top Fortune 50 companies coming together trying to fix healthcare. And then obviously JP Morgan, Berkshire, trying to do something, falling back, and Amazon, like, he's like, no, I'm going to do something. He's like, this is something that needs to be fixed. And specifically on the drug pricing side of the equation, his mindset, because he's in so many different consumer things, in my opinion, this is me just kind of playing it out. His mindset is very consumer centric first. And I think that's where he aligns a lot of his allegiance. if you look at cost plus is just really simply a lot of drug categories where you can actually take a low price point, or that price point's low. You could add a very small plus, which is 15%, and then you add shipping costs, and that's it. And it's 100% transparent, and every single drug that he can get his hands on where he can do that, he's doing that. And I think he's up to north of 2,000, 3,000 plus drugs now. And they're kind of trying to run the table on that, which is a really interesting idea. And it's getting a lot of traction in the marketplace.
That's great. I could see as a, if you have the resources as a father, as an employer, I mean, if you're providing benefits to employees and you could see that the process isn't working for them and you have the means to change things, that could be, motivation as well. Final question, because I feel like we could talk about the interview for as long as the interview went. How does it change your point of view as an investor? You didn't come out and say it, but you're backing these companies that are, you're hoping making substantial changes. They may be incremental in the eyes of some, but does it change your perspective as an investor? Like, I need to swing harder at these pitches to hit a home run. I need to make bigger changes. Or are you still committed to doing things the way you do it? I wouldn't expect you to change your entire philosophy based upon this conversation, but it must be in your head when you're looking at proposals now.
Yeah, Mark is compelling.
Yeah. and a little successful. He's kind of done all right.
Kind of successful, yes. You know, I think the one thing that he said in my research, I brought this up. I have lived by this model forever. That's why I had a lot of affinity to it and why I really wanted to talk to Mark about, like, really understanding the details. Like, it's amazing how many people have made a lot of money in healthcare and really don't understand a lot of the details. That's nothing new for us at LRV and how we think about investing. That's just how we work. We're very deep thematically, and that will continue to be that way. So we had a lot of affinity to that comment. His comment about thinking about this as an outsider did strike me a little bit about, you know, how does some of our investment decision discussions go when we think about what it is and where does it fit? Is it incrementally improving? Is it outsized improving? Like, even when you look at a lot of care delivery plays, a lot of the new care delivery plays, or even a lot of the insurance plays that we've seen kind of come up and come down, there wasn't a lot of new stuff. They were just trying to move existing money from the existing brands into their brands. And so that's Mark's whole point. And I think it's a really good for investors. I think it's a really good talk track about, you know, what are you doing as an investor group? And what are you doing in a transformation lens? Are you just trying to move somebody, I always say this, somebody else's cheese, or really the money, into your flow, but you're not really changing anything? But his point's like, how do you really change something substantially? I think is a really important talk track for most groups that are in the work that we do.
Just circling back to the series, do you have a sense of how long, how many episodes we're looking forward? That'll be is unclear at this point, but it'll be.
Yeah, we're still working on it. We've got a really great person lined up for the next episode after this that's on the PBM front and more on the insurer side, because, you know, Mark's completely counter on the other side of that trade. And so I thought a good counterbalance on those two, which is, you know, the view from a PBM or an insurer, someone who's been in the space for a long time, would be good. And then, you know, we're going to add one or two more. I think four at most, but three is probably likely on this particular setup.
Very cool. All right. Well, let's not delay any further. Let's get the podcast going. Your interview with Mark Cuban, who really needs no descriptor after that. People know who he is.
Well, welcome back to the Healthcare is Hard podcast. I have quite the guest today. So we're quite excited about having Mark Cuban here. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Keith.
I always start these things with sort of your journey. I know you're pretty vocal out there, so a lot of people know a little bit about your entrepreneurial journey and your background, but it'd be good to get a quick snippet and then tail it off into sort of understanding, you know, how you got into healthcare. I mean, you were just talking about a little bit in the preamble about how it's one of the easier areas to disrupt. It'd be great to sort of understand that side of it too.
Sure. I mean, I've been an entrepreneur since as long as I can remember. You know, as a kid in college, I started a company, Micro Solutions, when I was 25. That was one of the first local area network systems integrators, sold that to CompuServe, then started a company with Todd Wagner called AudioNet that turned into Broadcast.com, which was the very first streaming company. So we basically created the entire streaming industry on the content and delivery side, and then sold that, and then started HDNet, which is the first all high definition TV network, sold that, also bought the Mavs right around the same time. And then in 2017, when everybody in the Republican Party was talking about getting rid of the ACA, I was like, okay, I wonder what they could replace it with, you know, because no one was coming up with any answer. So I just started reading up about healthcare and getting into it. And then a few years later, I got a cold email from Dr. Alex Osmahansky, who basically said he wanted to create a compounding pharmacy in Denver that made generics that were in short supply. And I was like, that's a cool idea, but that's thinking too small. And this is right around the time the Pharma Bro was doing his thing. And I would just start peppering Alex with questions. I'm like, if this guy can buy up Daraprim and raise it by 7,500% or whatever it was, this is not an efficient market. Something's wrong with this market. So, you know, let's just not do compounding. Let's look at pharmacy as a whole. And just looking at it, it's really obvious at time and now that when an industry is opaque and there's no transparency, there's a lot of inefficiencies. There's a lot of arbitrage. There's a lot of games being played. And so once we got the, we're able to just register the URL, costplusdrugs.com, our destiny was set. And we made the decision that to truly develop trust, because when you look at the healthcare industry, the biggest missing component is trust. Hopefully you trust your doctor. Hopefully you trust your pharmacist. But the reality is you don't really trust anybody else in the entire healthcare supply chain. And so we decided we were going to show our cost. We were going to show our markup. We were going to show our fill fee. We were going to show our shipping. And we were going to make it so anybody and everybody could see it. And the more people that saw it, the better. And we launched on January 22nd of 2022 with maybe 150 drugs. I don't remember. It's just been nonstop ripping and roaring since then. And our biggest problem is just keeping up with it. And now we're up to 2,400 drugs plus. We keep on adding brands. We'll have more brands to announce. And the whole idea is to be as transparent as possible. We've got a wholesale section now where, you know, the meds we buy, we're making available to hospitals and pharmacies and whoever wants them at business.costplusdrugs.com. We've got a retail network where we're working primarily with indies and grocery chains, et cetera. And some bigger chains are coming on board too, really big chains actually. And so that you could just pick up a card, but it's not a discount card. It's more of a benefits card where we just have a bunch of additional features beyond just price. So that's kind of how we started, how I started and where we are.
When you step back, we kind of hit on this in the beginning. Is it probably one of the most inefficient industries you've ever invested in?
It's not so much that it's inefficient. It's the most opaque industry with the least amount of transparency. And that's what screws it up. I've never been in an industry where every single contract, the number one negotiating point is you can't share this with anybody else. And once that's in place, there is no industry, right? There's just dominant players who take advantage of the lack of transparency. And whether it's in their pricing mechanisms, whether it's creating subsidiaries and affiliated companies around the world, there's just, you know, you can go on for days about what the industry leaders are doing. And the reality is when you look at those big guys and ask the question, what is it that they do that companies truly need? Nothing. You know, what is it that's unique about their services? Nothing. Except being opaque and the lack of customer interest. It's not so much that it's inefficient, it's that it's by design to be controlled by the biggest players.
And when you step back, I listened to your New England Journal of Medicine AI podcast, which I thought was awesome.
Thank you.
And that's the second part. Second half is interview. I'd like to get to AI and your technology bent there. But you said something that has stuck with me ever since, which is read the manual. Can you explain that a little bit? And as you got into healthcare, and I could tell you a personal story. I can remember being at, I think it was HLTH, one of the first years, and you sat right next to me at a restaurant because I think you weren't even speaking. I think I was just working and reading the manual. And I'm just curious that philosophy and how you think about that for healthcare and how important that is.
Most people don't do the work. They're not going to read the ACA. They're not going to read the details about pharmacy benefit managers down to the smallest minutia. And when you read and you learn what's out there, especially in an industry with so many acronyms, that you get an edge because most people, they pick up their experience over years as they stay in the industry. But as things change, what I tend to do is just read everything I can get my hands on. Doesn't matter what it is, right? I'm reading it from a press release to, doesn't matter. If I can get my hands on it, I'm reading it.
Yeah. I only bring that up because I think you're so spot on. There's so many players in this space in particular that think they know what's going on, but they haven't actually gone and done a lot of that detailed work. And it's nuanced. I mean, because of the regulatory overlay here. When you sit and you think about Cost Plus, today it's mostly generics. Is that fair?
Yeah, mostly. Yeah, out of about 2,400 plus drugs, we just have a smattering of brands. That's where our focus is now because we've got almost every generic. We've got the full complement of generics, specialty generics all the way down. So now our focus is on adding more and more brands.
And do you think that the model, sort of the cost plus 15 plus shipping, you think that is uniquely suited for that platform?
It's fungible, right? We can adapt with the industry. Nothing's written in stone. We're just going to work with whatever allows us to be successful and allow our patients to be taken care of. We're not the patient to be taken care of. So that's why we have wholesale. That's why we have the card so you can walk into a local independent pharmacy. And we pay attention to what's happening in the industry. The independent pharmacies are getting shit on every single day. And so we're working with them to try to, you know, create situations where instead of having to pay, like some discount cards require to get traffic, we're increasing the fill fee that we're allowing them to charge. You know, there's just so many things that we can do. And to answer your question, is our model the right model? We're trying everything. We've only been literally shipping for 2 years. And so like any other startup, we're going to adapt where we need to adapt. Nothing's carved in stone.
Yeah, I guess more of it was going to other drug segments.
Well, for sure. Yeah, like we're building a manufacturing plant that will do generic injectables that are in short supply. So when you read about pediatric cancer drugs that aren't available, we'll be making them in our robotics facility in Dallas. Hopefully over the next few months, we'll be able to start shipping.
If you step back and you think about the pipeline, where 80% of most newly FDA approved drugs are specialty, and most of those are ridiculous high cost. It makes, you know, everything we have that we're talking about on this side very small. Is there a model? And we spend a lot of time trying to think about how is this country and how are these employers and how others are going to actually end up affording a lot of these precision drugs?
Well, that's not the hard part, right? So it's a great question though. So when you look at, you know, there's a hemophilia drug that costs $3.4 million. Everybody looks at it and says, okay, how's a patient going to afford that? Where does insurance play a role? What comes next? How do you pay for it? I think that's the exact wrong way, the opposite way to look at it. I look at it from the pharma company perspective. Why do they have to charge $3.4 million? Well, they have a big investment and it's a small addressable market. So the question I asked them when I sit in a meeting with big pharma, this is the exact question I ask, what's the nut you have to reach, right? If you have a total addressable market of 1,000 people and you've got to make $3.4 billion a year in revenue, okay, that's if you hit 100%, right? So if we're able to work with you and mitigate your risk so we can cover your nut, will you reduce that price? Sure. Yeah. I mean, because the way they think is I've got to deal with these insurance companies or big companies that are self-insured or and have catastrophic insurance. And how do I not get lasered out? How does it not all get put on me as the bad guy when somebody doesn't want to pay for it? So we're talking to them about creating a subscription service where a company can pay, you know, for their entire range of specialty drugs, X amount per employee per month. If something happens and one of your employees need this drug, then you just pay the out-of-pocket costs, going to the hospitals, et cetera, for the therapies. And they're like, yes, where do I sign up? Now, we're not necessarily the best enabler of that, but we're having that same conversation with people at CMS. And I'm not saying they're committing to do anything, but they definitely open their eyes. Because I told them, look, for Medicaid and Medicare patients, if big pharma company A has a drug that's they want to charge $1 million for, ISO thinks it's worth $1 million. It's curative as opposed to just therapy. What's the number that CMS should pay them so that everything else that they sell is their profit? And CMS is in a financial position to do that. Given that the number of specialty drugs is going to explode going into the future, it's probably the only way that works. And maybe socialized medicine to a certain extent for Medicare and Medicaid patients in particular is the way to go. People now are like, okay, the Netflix model for specialty drugs, you know, the high-end drugs, that could work because the key is risk mitigation for the pharmacy company so that they're incented to keep on investing. They can break even on government and make some money, but charge a whole lot less. And you can negotiate those things.
The reason I bring it up is not only where you sit in all of this, but the way you think about it, which is there needs to be a new model for that particular problem.
Yeah, for sure. That's just the way progress happens, right? And I'm not saying I come up with the ideas. This is not something so dramatically unique or different, a subscription model. But at the same time, you got to put yourself, and I think that's what we've done at Cost Plus that's a little bit different. People try to say, well, how do I help the patient more? How do I save the patient money? No, what is the perspective of the insurance company? What is the perspective of the PBM? Is it captive? What is the perspective of the pharmacy? What is the perspective of other providers all the way in big pharma? Then when you figure out everybody else's positioning and what their needs are to be profitable and successful, Then you get to the patient. And that's what we've done. That's the approach we continue to take.
And when you step back, since you've been sitting in this for a while, thinking about the value chain, and now that you're going to get into manufacturing, and you think about what CVS announced on the biosimilars, and you think about Civica, which is an aggregation of health systems trying to get to short-dated drugs, but doing other things now too. Do you feel like more and more people are going to be up and down that value chain? And even looking at distributors?
They're shuffling deck chairs on the Titanic.
Yeah.
They're doing the same thing, just differently. It's like the biosimilars. For Humira, what is it, $8,800 before rebates a month? And Coherus with Yusimry is $574 plus cold chain shipping. And that's what they do. That tells you everything.
Right.
They announce a cost plus model, but they don't tell you their cost. Come on. Now, we know they're going to come and step at us at some time. They yell at our partners and say, if you do business with cost plus, we're going to do da, da, da. No, we didn't say that. Of course, we would never say that, right? But that's what they say. And that's okay, because that just tells me they're not willing to actually change their model. And that's good for us, because we'll keep on growing because patients want us. And that's not to say we don't have growing pains and issues and problems. We do. But we'll keep on adding features, whether it's manufacturing, whether it's destroying their margins on specialty drugs, which is where they make all their money and rip off people the most. I mean, those are the things we're going to do, and it's going to be hard. And look, we're still a pimple on an elephant's ass right now relative to the industry. And we know that. And they know that. And that kind of keeps it in harmony. But we'll keep on growing and we'll see what happens.
Yeah. And that's where I was going to go to next, which is, I think, because of you, Mark, and obviously you guys are success to date, but so much capital and so many plays have gone into like PBM disruption, drug disruption, and they've all like not even come close to what you've done.
Well, that's because they try to work inside the system.
Yeah.
Look, if I'm 25 years old and I'm starting this company, I'm working inside kind of like GoodRx, and I'm trying to out GoodRx, because I know if I get big enough, they'll buy me. And if they buy me for enough money, I go buy a sports team. But now that's not the situation that I find myself in. I'm trying to look at this as, okay, how can we change healthcare? And there is a direct path without legislation from where we are now to completely turning the healthcare system upside down. And it simply starts by, when you look at the biggest players in the industry, what is the unique functions they offer that self-insured employers need?
Yeah.
Can you think of anything that the big three insurance companies or big three PBMs offer that's unique other than scale?
Yeah. You have to step back on it and go, what is the intent, right, for a lot of this creation over the decades, which, you know, you could look at some of the trending Medicare costs over the last number of years, and there's a question mark, like what's actually happening? Is value starting to take an impact? Is some of the utilization, some of the prior auth taking an impact, some of the utilization management?
But that's not the question. The question is, why is it happening?
Yeah.
Why are they doing this when they know people's lives are impacted?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a much, much, much bigger issue here.
Yeah. I mean, and they know what they're doing, and they make up the biggest bunch of bullshit to justify it.
But if you step back on that, Mark, and you think about your, let's just take the cost plus transparency trust model, Matt, is there other areas in your mind that this can impact outside of drugs? So
well, yeah.
Like, for example, like look at Walmart. Walmart's trying to do it. I don't know how successful that's been on care delivery.
Well, two different things. Okay, so care delivery providers will be providers and they'll do their thing. We're not going to get into the business of opening up primary care clinics or ambulatory surgery centers, nothing like that. That's all trying to get vertically integrated. Amazon, Walgreens, everybody's trying to do that. And it's smart to try to do that because you want to be cradle to grave. Should Amazon know when you're pregnant before you probably do, right? And owning that customer, and that's great. And when you run with the elephants, there's the quick and the dead, right? So we've got to be agile to be able to do these things. We're going to find our way. We're going to bring transparency into other components of healthcare. And I'll give you the perfect example. My companies, 700 employees, 1,000 lives now, nothing huge, but we self-insure. And like most CEOs that self-insure, I didn't look at it as a competitive advantage or a core competency. We used the same employee benefits consultant we've been using for decades. And now when we started all this, I was like, okay, I got to eat my own dog food. I've got to start really digging into my own costs and understanding them. Read the manual, right? First thing is our employee benefits consultant is charging us $30 per employee per month, $2.1 million a year. I'm like, that's insane. That is insane. Then I look, because I self-insure, I said, let's get some claims from our insurer, right? They don't want to give them to us. That's not unusual, right? It's not like because it's me or whatever. They don't want to give it to us. They're going to delay it. I'm like, okay, well, I found some and I got a good understanding, particularly for digital services. So my son has a little issue. And so he's got to go get an x-ray. And my wife's like, okay, I'll get the insurance card. I'm like, no, take the credit card because it's my money either way. Just go pay cash. You see negotiated rates that my employee benefit consultant connected me with an insurance company whose negotiated rates are 250% of Medicare. And I was able to just walk in off the streets and get this x-ray and, you know, another CT thing we had to do for a third of the price. I'm going ding, 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 ding. This thing is messed up. So cut out the employee benefits consultant. Why am I using my insurance company? My cost for insurance was $29,000 for a family of five every single year on average. I'm like, that's insane, right? That is completely insane. Why am I paying premiums when I self-insure? Well, they put together the network and they have some really nice apps. I'm like, the app has value. I'll agree. But wait, they're charging me $18 per employee per month just to have access to their network in addition to the premiums I'm paying. I look in the mirror and I said, Mark, you are a moron. You are a moron for having let this go on. So we're in the process now. There's companies that will help you direct contract with systems around the country, around the world, big, little, ASCs, primary care providers, surgery, you name it. You can direct contract with them. What I've learned since, and you talk about reading the manual, and it never crossed my mind, even though it's patently obvious, when somebody has a deductible or a copay or co-insurance and they have to go to the hospital, company taking the risk on that is the hospital.
Right.
And then when I have a hassle with HR, it's always because an employee was denied their pre-auth. So the doctor and the provider that our wonderful insurance company connected us with is now having to run through hoops, which upsets the employee, impacts their wellness, and eats up a chunk of time in HR. I'm like, this is insane as well. So now we're direct contracting. We're going to them and saying, we'll pay you cash up front. I'll even put a deposit on, right? Because I'm not paying any more insurance premiums. I'll keep on getting my catastrophic insurance and we'll adjust that. But no more insurance premium, gone, dead, over, because I think that's stupid. We'll direct contract. I'll take all that money, that $29,000 a year for a family of five. I'll let it earn 4.5%, 5%. And when I'll direct contract and I'll pay them cash. And the prices we're negotiating for cash pay and cash prepay with no pre-offs, no claim denials either, is in some cases under Medicare, 100% of Medicare or less.
Do you think other employers will get on that bandwagon ever?
But wait, there's more. This is where it changes. When we talk to these providers and do these negotiations, the first thing we tell them is we're going to disclose and publish everything. The contract, the prices, everything that we do. So it's a template for everybody else. So instead of them having to use the big insurance companies as a sales funnel for patients, because that's why these negotiations and these messes occur, because the providers, particularly the big hospital systems, need those 25 million lives that big insurance company has, right? As a funnel for patients, they work out their pricing or whatever, depending on all the different variables. And we're walking in and saying, look, you don't have to deal with AR. You're not going to lose any money because we'll make sure everything is paid. There's no real deductibles because I'm saving so much of my insurance premiums. I've got an option. Since my prices are going to be completely transparent and I'll have catastrophic insurance, I can pay my employee more and let them do their own stuff, right? And deal with their own costs if and when, if they're younger. Or I'll just do it directly like we are, publish all the prices. And now instead of the insurance company being the funnel, Cost Plus Drugs is going to be the funnel because everybody's just going to replicate what we're doing from the template that we publish. And we just keep on publishing those templates and publishing those templates for all the contracts. And that is what the difference is going to be. And that's how you disrupt the entire healthcare system transparently. It's that easy.
Yeah, this is 100% a whole different podcast on the employer side of this equation.
If you think about it from an employer's perspective, if you self-insure, you are the problem.
Yeah.
It's not the big three insurance companies. It's not the big three PBMs that their problem. They're taking advantage of the stupidity of the big companies that self-insure. J&J got sued for not living up to their fiduciary responsibility for one of their employees. that's going to happen over and over and over again. And these companies who get their CFOs to negotiate these rebates on the drug side, they think they're, you know, hey, I've got this cash coming back. Look what I did. All those rebates are paid for by your oldest and sickest employees. They're the ones that are using it and paying the copays and have the biggest healthcare problems. That's who's paying for it. There's going to be article after article and on the Wall, in the Wall Street Journal and everywhere else of big companies, again, getting sued and embarrassed because A, they worked with the big three insurance companies and PBMs. That's going to be proven to be a huge mistake. And B, their sickest employees are subsidizing this $5, $10, $20 million they're getting on their balance sheet, and it's directly traceable back.
It is a great point, and it's a very nuanced point to your point about on the employer side, kind of people that are involved, who's involved, all the stuff that goes on, and that stuff, in my opinion, is needs to be unpacked in a much different way than it is.
So just imagine this, Keith. Let's just say 10 of the Fortune 100 change and direct contract everything.
They've tried though, Mark. Like they've tried and they don't do it. It was Health Transformation Alliance. That was a whole, HTA was a whole thing to get the top Fortune 50 to do all this stuff. And I still am at a loss. You can tell it's a little bit of passion project here. Like I'm a little bit of a loss that nothing ever came of that. Like nothing. JP Morgan got at it. Berkshire got at it.
When I talked to JP Morgan and those guys, they kind of beat around the bush why they think it went wrong. But at the same time, there was no transparency. You didn't see them publish their contracts at all for people to give them feedback.
You need your mindset. That's the difference. You need an outside-in mindset.
Just an entrepreneurial mindset. If I were going to start this business again, what would I do? If you were going to start the healthcare industry from scratch, what would you do? You take it back to 1955.
You're totally right. You're totally right there. Well, I know we're getting close to time here. So let's switch subjects real quick because this is another thing that you're passionate about and I'm passionate about. And you know more probably than I do about it. So AI, you've been in the technology game for a long time, thinking about sort of the intersection of AI and specifically over the last number of years, generative AI, and how you think that will impact healthcare, yes or no? And then how big of a hype cycle is it now? How should people be thinking about this? We've done a handful of episodes with folks on this topic.
Well, it depends on where you sit in the food chain, right? It's going to be different. There's going to be customer service applications with bots, et cetera. Everybody sees that and knows that. But I think the bigger question people, and then there's the drug side. Can you create and discover new drugs by using AI? I'm sure you can. But the bigger issue is what data do you train your AI on and how do you source that and who owns that data? I'm a believer that there's going to be millions of models. Keith will have his own model. Mark will have his own model. My kids will have their own model. Right? As it gets cheaper and cheaper to train, I'll be able to take the million emails that I have, plug them in there. And 100 years from now, long after I'm gone, you'll be able to ask me questions because this AI large language model knows everything that I did. But from a healthcare perspective, it's going to be different because branding is so important in healthcare. There is no way that the Mayo Clinic and Cleveland Clinic and Cedars-Sinai and Stanford and you name it are just going to let all the research and knowledge that they have be integrated into a single large language model to be used by everybody unless they get paid an insane, extreme amount of money. And I wouldn't either. If I'm them, I'm saying, okay, this is my differentiated knowledge. It's going to go in my model. And if this is where my expertise is, this is how we're training it. If you want to learn this stuff, it's $25 a month, or on a professional version, it's a $10,000 a month. And that's how you get to ask questions to Mayo Clinic GPT. And so you're going to see all these medical models. Now, there'll be some scenarios where maybe Google, maybe whoever puts up a boatload of money and pays them enough to make it worthwhile to for them to license the content. But they'll just stop publishing other than a research journals, anything and everything that they do to prevent it from being ingested into somebody else's model.
And do you think your pillars of trust and transparency, does this potentially set us even farther back?
No, I mean, look, with transparency on large language models, it's a little bit harder, but you're getting more and more technology that deals with chain of custody so you know where it originates. Because with medical, obviously, you know, you can't let it hallucinate. You've got to have the knowledge there to confirm it. And that's one more reason for companies to retain. Then it's just a question of economics. So even if there's 100 of, let's just say 20 of the top research institutions, care providing institutions. Just like there's different research journals that you have to pay a lot to, you might have to subscribe to a lot of different large language models and ask the same question to 10 of them and then try to find the source of it, the doctor or researcher or whoever that put it together and go from there. There's so much money at stake, and the institutions and providers pay so much money to create that information. And on top of that, the other big thing is there's latency, right? So even if it goes into a large language model that happened yesterday, you're not training that model every 15 minutes. And so there's always going to be latency. And so I can see a change in how we deal with advanced information beyond just subscription fees to research publications.
And our base case is sort of thinking about it from, hey, look, we got all this unstructured data, to your point, everybody's got a model and you get better search for unstructured data. The upside case is this gets embedded in the OS.
There's just no way. If you're Cleveland Clinic, Mayo, pick one. Why would you just provide your information that you're spending a fortune on and give some hospital in some small town doctor the ability to say, hey, all I got to do is look it up in the OS, the operating system, large language model, and I have all the information I need. I've got as much info as the leading surgeon from Mayo Clinic.
Yeah. My point is more about what you carry around in your pocket. Like, does that become the nature of the game more than healthcare? And then how does that transpose?
Yeah, just generically for everybody? Yeah, of course. And there'll be meta front ends for different large language models that'll learn. You'll ask it a question first, and it'll go to the millions of models and determine which one gives you the best output. What do they call it? RAGs, right? So it'll just be able to look. And there's the other side of it, which is the vectors, right? The database lookups. I just don't see that as the long-term solution, just because just looking up in a database and trying to make that part of your answer, I think it's easier to do, but I don't think it meets the expectations of users.
That's fair. It looked like you created an AI bootcamp for high schoolers.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess your point of view on literacy around all this would be good before we go to the last question.
Yeah, it's important, right? You know, from a business perspective, there's only two types of companies in the world, those who are great at AI and everybody else. And if you're not good and conversational and understand AI beyond just doing prompts, it's going to be really, really hard to succeed within a corporate environment or as an entrepreneur. And so working with kids and helping them grasp the concepts, they're not difficult concepts to understand. It's just about reading the manual, right? And getting them in front of you so you can be comfortable with them. When we go back, I've been in the tech industry long enough, understanding DOS was a big deal. Used to be people were sent to training to learn how to use a spreadsheet. Right. I remember in order to sell Lotus 1-2-3 spreadsheet, I had to go to training to be authorized. When the internet hit to stream, it was just a pain because you had to download multiple clients and stubs and all this stuff. When a kid knew HTML, it was considered a big deal because they were doing websites for corporations. We're at that stage now with AI where there's a lot of growth and improvements, but at some point, it'll just, to your point, be part of the OS and something that everybody does. And so I just wanted to make kids start to feel comfortable.
Oh, that's great. No, I think there's a huge literacy problem out there. And to your point, I don't think it really, they're complicated, but it's not complicated when you get the right level of schooling and all this. Last question, just sort of when you think about panning out the next 10 years, given that you're in the middle of all this now in healthcare, what doesn't change in 10 years, which is a question I love to ask. And then what does change in your mind?
Patients don't change. Their needs don't change. The amount of attention they need doesn't change. The fear of being in the healthcare system doesn't change. The fear of paying for it is where we want to change it. The fear of not understanding exactly what's going on and not trusting is what we want to change. We just want to introduce trust. And trust is at odds with maximizing profitability for a public company. You can't have both. There's just no way, unless you're willing to take the stock price hit and watch your stock price go down 90% and just say, you know what? We found our new baseline 90% lower, but we're going to operate it as a trusted organization and be completely transparent, et cetera, et cetera. You're SOL. You can't do it. And this whole concept of we just created this subsidiary in Ireland or wherever, and we just bought into this and that so that we hide it and we have this rebate aggregator or that, you know, that's going to change. That's going to change dramatically. And that's my goal, so that it's really, really straightforward, understandable, trustworthy. Now, it's not going to happen overnight. It might take 20 years. I don't know, but it will happen. You guys know as investors, if you can make your customer happier and more comfortable and trusting the organization you're investing in, you will win. And when you look at your competitors and you say, what is the one thing that differentiates them, that gives them a moat, and it's only scale, that's the industry you want to invest in every single time. When you look at insurance companies and PBMs in particular and how they operate and the vertical integration and how they're just shitting on their patients, and obviously they're not going to agree with that, and then the pharmacies that they own, we see everything that's happening there and the impact on patients there. There's a direct line to doing this. And those people who are into single payer, once you have complete transparency, then any city, state, county, or any organization can say, we'll just pay for it because we know what the costs are.
My last question on this one really is, do you view healthcare as a private good, a public-private good? How do you think about it?
I think healthcare is a right. I think we all have the right to healthcare. The question is, who pays for it and how? And the way the system is designed right now, it's not designed in the best interest of the patient. And so when I talk about potentially single payer, once things are transparent, then government can use AI and machine learning in particular to try to figure out what the optimal payment model is. You can start introducing healthcare as a service from government, things that the subscription aspect of it. If you start with the high-end specialty drugs and CMS goes in there and pays for them on a subscription model for Medicare and Medicaid patients, and they create an option for corporations to buy in at the same price effectively, Katie barred the door. That gives them negotiation power to potentially stop the evergreening of patents. Hey, if you evergreen patents and it's an evergreen product, we're not going to give you the subscription model, which effectively pays you for all your R&D for your launch of all this, right? We're not going to help you along the way. And then that leads to the opportunity of the government potentially backstopping the providers of catastrophic insurance so that somebody who's 21 and wants the ACA but doesn't want to pay for platinum, who effectively has a $7,000 deductible, so what's the point of even buying it, can buy catastrophic insurance for a de minimis amount. And corporations, it's just like if you look in Florida for homeowners insurance, that industry is gone because of climate change, gone. And the government basically is having to subsidize it, right? If you follow that, that same scenario when applied to catastrophic insurance for healthcare changes everything. Everything.
Well, Mark, this has been awesome. I really appreciate you doing it. More importantly, your passion and looking at it from the outside in, which I love. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me, Keith. It was a lot of fun. Enjoyed it.
All right, well, that's a wrap. Thanks for joining us on this episode of Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders. You can find Keith Figlioli on Twitter and on LinkedIn. You can find me there as well. I'm Tom Salemi, Editorial Director of Device Talks. Join us next time. We'll have another great episode of Healthcare is Hard, a podcast for insiders waiting for you.